In today's episode, Lauren Rodriguez shares her husband Kiani's legal battle over Samurai Wallet. It highlights the risks that innovators face and why regulatory clarity is essential for privacy tech on Bitcoin. This one is for every builder. As a reminder, this podcast is for educational purposes only. If you enjoyed the content we're producing, we encourage you to leave us a comment, share, or give us a follow, as this all helps us greatly. Thank you.
This isn't for everyone. It's for the ones who know the old system is broken and are ready to build something that lasts. Welcome to the Build with Bitcoin podcast.
Welcome to another episode of Build with Bitcoin. I'm Lynn Bairstow, co-host along with Israel Munoz, my other co-host. And today we have a really special episode, a little different than what we normally do. We're talking with Lauren Rodriguez. And Lauren is the wife of Kiani Rodriguez, who is currently in jail serving time for software that he developed, the Samurai Wallet, along with his co-founder. We feel it's really important to bring this story to the attention of more people. As you know, Build with Bitcoin is all about innovation on the Bitcoin protocol and also the surrounding freedom technologies. So when you're at risk of going to jail for something that you've developed, and we'll get into the specifics of the case as we talk with Lauren, that's something that I think from an innovation standpoint, developers and investors in these technologies need to be aware of. But I had the pleasure of meeting Lauren first in April of this year at BitBlock Boom. And when you put the human side to it, together with the risk to innovation, it's just such an important story to share with you. So we hope you enjoy this episode and listen around. And I'd like to welcome Lauren. Lauren, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today and to share your story so that more people can be aware of what your husband's going through, what the risks are to innovation and to innovators, and to hopefully be able to help him and help you in your efforts to get a presidential pardon for Kiani and Bill. So welcome.
Ellen, hi, Israel. Thank you both so much for having me on and being able to share this story with your audience.
Lauren, we have been obviously following this because of its impact on innovation and founders for quite a while. But for our audience, they may not be familiar with you and with the case of Kiani and Bill and Samurai Wallet. Can you give us a brief background on why you're here with us today?
Sure. So as you said, my name is Lauren Rodriguez. My husband, Kiani Rodriguez, as well as Bill Hill, his business partner, are in federal prison. So they started Samurai Wallet in around 2015. It was a non-custodial open source Bitcoin wallet that had some added, again, non-custodial, meaning they never held any users' funds, added privacy features. And they operated, you could download it from Google Play, as well as other things, for around 10 years. They had legal advice saying that what you're doing is staying within the bounds of FinCEN, who's the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network. That's a regulator in charge of kind of financial industry, and Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies have fallen under their purview for the most part. And they had put out guidance in 2013 and then reiterated that in 2019 as to, what was required of money service businesses or cryptocurrency wallets that were non-custodial. So there's pretty good guidelines around there. And happily developing the space, they loved Bitcoin, loved what they did, and were really excited to bring new innovative features to the market.
And these features are really based around privacy, about being able to, because I think there's a little bit of a misconception that people feel that Bitcoin is, only for obfuscating financial transactions, but it's actually a very transparent blockchain or time chain where transactions can be traced. So one of the purposes of the Samurai Wallet was to actually keep some of the privacy among the transactions that you were making. Is that accurate to say?
Yeah. So, as you said, Bitcoin is an open ledger, which means anyone with an internet connection, if they have a starting point, can find out, who transactions you're making, who you're paying, who's paying you, potentially your net worth. So while there's great benefit to having an open ledger, there's also potentially some downside. And, you know, for me, if I'm buying a coffee at a cafe, I don't need the barista to know, you know, how much money I give to my church, or if I'm making political contributions to someone. That's just none of their business. And that's, you know, we don't accept that in the legacy system. And the privacy technology tools that Samurai offered allowed that transaction level privacy that we would expect in the legacy system.
And Lauren, could we get into a little bit of the your perspective and your point of view of when Kiani is actually arrested and brought in for building out Samurai Wallet? You know, your side of the story. How deep was your awareness of his work prior to the day that he was arrested? And what was the day of his arrest like for you as well? Can you walk us through that?
Sure. So prior, I was, you know, this was a small startup. Bill and Kioni started together. They was working for 10 years. They did have other contributors to the code. And while I'm not technical and in that sense, I did understand the project and kind of what it was doing and was really proud of what they were building. You know, this wasn't a get rich quick scheme. This was something that they really believed in. And the value behind, and it was really true to their principles as, you know, people. So the, like I said, they, you know, they did this for about 10 years, and on April 24th, 2024, at 5 a.m, our house was raided by the FBI and, you know, other agencies. That was our first introduction that anything was amiss at all. You know, our house was surrounded. They had a loudspeaker on an MRAP, which is an armored vehicle, and announced, like, come out with your hands raised. And we were woken from sleep. And, yeah, I was worried about my dog and trying to get a leash on him and trying to get outside, you know, trying to obey the commands, because, again, you're just woken up and you don't know what's going on. And we walk out our front door and we have multiple red dots, laser sights from guns pointed at our hearts, you know, on our chests, and told to get down. We're handcuffed and separated. And I think my initial reaction was they have the wrong house, right? We hear about this, that they're trying to hit like criminals, right? Like there's a meth lab next door and they accidentally raid the grandma who's completely innocent. So that was my initial thought, like just because the overwhelming presence of all these people and the guns and the lights and the drone and, you know, just, and then I realized that no, they're after Kioni, they're after my husband. And at that point, and they don't show you a warrant, which was, because I asked the state, I said, why are you here? Like, don't you have to show me a warrant? And they said, no, that's just in the movies. We don't have to show you a warrant. And so it wasn't until later that once the public defender had talked to Kioni in Pittsburgh, where we live, and she explained that this had to do with Samurai Wallet and his development of it. And he had two conspiracy charges. One, conspiracy to operate an unlicensed money transmitting business, and conspiracy to money launder. We were shocked when he heard that, because we just kind of figured, well, it's new technology. They don't understand it. They just got this wrong. We'll explain it and it'll, you know, they'll get it and they'll drop the charges, right? Because we aren't money laundering. We, you know, aren't operating an unlicensed money transmitting business by what the regulator says. Like, so they just don't understand. And yeah, that was kind of the initial reaction to this whole event was, it's wrong. They got it wrong. It'll be cleared up quickly. And it wasn't.
And operating for 10 years, and you'd mentioned, Lauren, that you already had legal advice. So as things were developing, and obviously new technology in the crypto space was developing quite rapidly in the last 5 years, and regulations were. But you had been updating regularly, and you had no sense, and you actually had confirmation that you were operating, because you weren't holding any funds, that you were operating within the guidelines of Vincen, correct? So you were making an effort, Kioni and Bill were making an effort to comply.
Yeah, FinCEN gave out, you know, really clear guidance that to be a money transmitter, you must take custody and control of users' funds. And that makes sense. It fits in with, you know, past regulations, you know, going to the 1960 MSB, like, you know, kind of the Bank Secrecy Act, like those laws, like this was established understanding of these regulations that the whole industry was being built around. And yes, as we said, we had legal advice and they were following this and the whole industry was. And at no point did anyone come and say, hey, you know, we think criminals might be using your software, or can you explain this? Or, you know, you need to come in and answer questions, or, you know, even as sometimes they'll send like a spoilation letter, which is like, don't destroy anything because it's like a notice of investigation. We're investigating you. It was nothing until the raid. That was our first interaction with U.S. law enforcement. You know, previously we had received from, and I don't know if it was law enforcement or just legal representatives inquiring about what kind of information Samurai could provide on a specific user or address. And that was always passed off to the attorney, and he would reply, and they completely understand. But none of those were from U.S. law enforcement.
Drilling in a little bit to this FinCEN point, Lauren, I mean, why wasn't this a clear defense and kind of case breaker in Kiani's favor? Because common sense would tell you precisely what we were just touching on, right? There's this very, what's supposed to be clear distinction between building a custodial versus a non-custodial service. And most people involved in innovation and builders in the space, that's kind of where people tend to draw the line, right? As far as safe zone versus gray zone or red zone. Samurai was non-custodial. They were building code. They wrote code that allowed people to transact in a more private manner. And with this FinCEN statement, you would think that, I mean, that's coming from a government agency. So why did this not clearly take the case in your favor? Where was the deviation there?
Well, in fact, we found, this is a year into the court proceedings, we found out that 6 months prior to the indictment, the prosecutors in our case had gone to FinCEN and asked them directly, do you think Samurai Wallet is in violation of these? Do you think they're a money service business? And FinCEN said, no, they don't take custody. We don't think they need a license. And they decided to bring charges anyways. And what it seems to me, and what it's kind of some statements that the prosecution has made in our case and other similar ones, is that this is regulation by prosecution, meaning they don't like what the regulator's saying. They think they know better, and they're going to bring charges and set law that way instead of the way the U.S. government, you know, law is supposed to be written, which is through Congress, through that process, and then through the regulators to enforce that law. It's not how it's supposed to work. And when this came out, the prosecution held this information, which is exculpatory evidence. It's called a Brady violation or a Brady evidence, because they held it back so long. So they had given us, I think it was over 10 terabytes of data of discovery, which one of the attorneys said, if you printed it out on paper, would go from the, you know, Earth to the moon and back 17 times or some crazy number like that. And yet they left out this piece of information, which to me tells me a few things. That one, they knew what they did. They knew this was wrong. They knew this was exculpatory, or else why not share it if they didn't think it was, you know, not that big of a deal. And so we were obviously, and our lawyers thought that this is the piece of evidence. This is going to change it. They're going to have to drop the case. How can you charge for something when the regulators told them not to? And unfortunately, that wasn't the case. We had that motion as well as some other motions, all stacked up together. The judge at the time, Judge Berman, wanted to have kind of a big court hearing where he would go over multiple pieces of, you know, we had a motion to dismiss. We had some, the Brady motion violation to just I guess, argue, discuss for him to rule on, some other procedural things, as well as like amicus briefs and stuff. And so he wanted all of this in one big court hearing. That was going to be our first really large court hearing for him to decide all these things. And a few days, 3 or 4 days before we were supposed to go in and present this, we had to change a judge. We decided to go ahead and go, you know, we're still excited to present all this. Again, this is our first real time to be heard as the defense. Before this, it had all been one side from the prosecutions, and they kind of skew things. And so we go before our new judge, ready to have, again, a couple hours of hearings, arguments back and forth between our defense attorneys and the prosecution. And we walk into court, and the new judge says, you know, good morning. I'm denying all motions. Have a good day. And it was like as short as that. And so again, it should have been the game changing piece, as well as our, you know, wonderful motion to dismiss and some other things. And it wasn't. It's been a real eye opener to how the justice system works. And in the U.S. justice system, the judge is the king or queen of their courtroom. And it really is what they say goes. And there's, you know, there are appeals process, but during that point, you can't really appeal until much further down the line. And you just kind of have to accept their ruling.
And Lauren, this was after how long of a period that you had been working with your attorneys from April 24 when he was taken in custody to then? And there was also a change in the administration, too, during that time where it appeared that there was a more open-mindedness to the new technologies that were being developed around crypto and fintech and Bitcoin. What was the timeline like? And then this whole change of judge, when I was studying the case a little bit deeper, that really just, it just blew my mind that they could do that after you're working with one and understanding the power that they have. What was that whole process like? And then what did that leave you with in terms of your ability to, you know, to go forward and make, and please explain too the ultimate decision of why Keone is in prison for making the plea deal.
Sure. So, you know, as you mentioned, when President Trump got elected, we were thrilled because he is pro U.S. innovation and bringing business back to the United States, and that includes cryptocurrency, you know, business companies development. And we even had from his at the time Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche had wrote a really great memo saying we're going to start going after the criminals, not the innovators and coders of the tools that criminals may be using. And that kind of makes sense to, I think, most people when they hear that everyone knows that the internet's used by bad people, but it doesn't mean that the internet's inherently bad or evil, right? It's also used by plenty of law-abiding citizens. And so we're really excited about that. But the thing is with, you know, a new president comes in and a new administration, and they're at the high level, but the people at the AUSA level, the prosecutors that are actually deciding kind of to bring these cases and charges and try these cases, they stay kind of regardless of the administration. They're just bureaucrats that work in the government. And they didn't change their opinion on cryptocurrencies. And I think we see that in other parts of the government at large, that there's a lot of people within that really think that everything to do with crypto is bad. In fact, another judge in the Southern District of New York, not one that oversaw our case, but he had made a comment around the time of our case that he doesn't see the point of cryptocurrencies other than for scams and fraud. And so that's talking about a whole industry. And in the U.S., I think there is estimated between 35 and 70 million people that hold Bitcoin. So that's a huge percentage of the population that they're just condemning flat out. And that's just their mindset. And unfortunately, and I think with any new technology, you know, you look at AI or just different things, you're going to have those people that are just adamantly against it until they understand that it's not so bad. And that's definitely the case here. So as far as kind of the progression, once this judge gave that clear kind of denying everything, we went back and we were pretty discouraged because up until that point, we were ready to be able to present our case and, you know, to a jury and have them understand the truth of the matter. But as I said, with a judge and the control they have over their courtroom, they get to decide what kind of defense you're allowed to put on. They get to decide what witnesses and what evidence a jury is allowed to see and, you know, and hear. So really they determine the outcome of a trial more so than what a jury does, because a jury has such a limited view. And at that time we're advised that, you know, we're not going to be able to put on a defensive counsel. At that point when the judge changed and we sat back and had a discussion with our attorneys, and they advised that we wouldn't be able to put on the kind of defense that we were planning on, which was a defensive counsel, which is a valid defense in the U.S. Court system. But we were advised that she would not allow that kind of defense. And there's a lot of other things that went into it. We were nervous because it's like going into a fight with both hands tied behind your back. And with a judge acting as, you know, fifth prosecutor from the bench, that's really not a fair fight. And you're looking at, you know, 25 years in prison. And that's a life changing and potentially, you know, life ending amount of time. That was the point when the prosecution came to us and they said, you have 24 hours to decide. You, meaning Keone and Bill, both have to agree. If one agrees and the other doesn't, we're pulling the deal. And the deal was they were going to drop the money, conspiracy to money launder charge if they pled guilty to conspiracy to operate an unlicensed money transmitter business. And again, this is the charge that the regulator who gives out the license says, no, you don't need a license. But it was a really hard decision. You know, there's so many variables that go into it when you have 24 hours to discuss, and you know in your heart that there wasn't any intent to break any laws, and that, you know, you didn't do what you're being accused of, and how do you say you did? And then also there's, you know, the huge financial cost of, to, you know, it's estimated to take a case to through trial, a complex case like anything involving cryptocurrencies are in the Southern District of New York. You're looking at about $13 million per defendant, and we just didn't have that kind of money. So, you know, a lot went into it, and it was a really tough decision, but they did decide that, you know, they would take the deal because it was looking at a downside of 5 years instead of 25 years, which is a much, you know, larger, much, you know, greater time in prison difference. And it was still really hard. And when we went to the change of plea, they had to do something called an allocution, I don't know if I'm saying that right, statement. And that's where you kind of put in your own words how you broke the law. And Keone said, he's like, I don't want to lie. Like, I'm just not going to get up there and lie. Like, whatever statement I make, it needs to be true. And so what they said, what Keone said, and this also goes back and forth because the prosecution has to agree and, you know, the defense and stuff. And so they agreed on language. And he said, you know, I along with my co-defendant Bill, you know, created, maintained Samurai Wallet, knowing that it was possible that some of the users might be of criminal nature or, you know, something like that. And, you know, the users transacted because they did the transacting, that's the way that the code works. And, you know, I allowed it to continue. So something along those lines, which was all factually true. You know, if anyone creates any tool, they know that it can be used potentially by a bad actor. Doesn't mean they agree with that. Doesn't mean they encourage it. But they know that it could be used in that way. And so I think he felt good about that. He's still proud of what they built because it did. It helped a lot of people. It helped a lot of people in even, you know, other countries, repressive regimes. They had you know, a decent sized user base in Iran. And this is actually something that the prosecution had brought up as a negative, that they were, they weren't helping the, you know, the Iranian regime. These were the freedom fighters who were using this technology in some cases to protect their lives. These are, you know, individuals who were imprisoned for fighting for freedom against an oppressive regime. And they're proud of that work. They're proud that they were able to help people like that.
Lynn and I are partners at Baselayer Advisors, where through our experience and network with venture capital partners, we connect interested investors with unique opportunities in the space and advise startups on their growth and fundraising. Visit our website's advisory section to learn more.
Warren, in researching this, we looked at the U.S. Government's press release after the plea deal was arranged and whatnot. And I'm going to ask some hard questions because, you know, there is some language in there where they cited some WhatsApp messages and emails that Keone and Bill had wrote. And that was, as I understand it, part of their case against it. I mean, I think everything we've talked about, and Israel and I are certainly on the side of, you know, creating tools for innovation and privacy and self-sovereignty. So we understand that. But from their side of it, there were some statements made. I mean, it's great to protect the freedoms of those who are being repressed. But can you talk a little bit about some of the statements that were, in your words, taken out of context that kind of created this perception that they were actively advocating for criminals to use Samurai Wallet?
Sure. You mentioned the WhatsApp message, and that was a message between, and this was, I'm not sure the exact year it was written, but it was years before they had even the technology within the wallet that the government was citing. So it was a message between Keone and a high school friend that would occasionally message him and ask him about Bitcoin related things or this or that. And he had asked him, well, what's a mixer? And Keone gave a kind of offhanded flippant comment. Well, mixer is like money laundering for Bitcoin. And again, this is before they had their CoinJoin implementation, which is different than a mixer. So, mixer in the traditional sense is custodial. It is something where you, as a user of a mixer, would send another party your Bitcoin. They would pool it in their custody, in their wallet with other people, and then they would send it out again, transfer it out of their custody back to you or back to a different location. So they would have control. This intermediary would have control. The way CoinJoin worked, and this was, you know, a technology that was written by Gregory Maxwell, who's a encryption developer. This, I think he wrote about this in 2013, and then it was implemented by wallets later. A CoinJoin works as a collaborative transaction. So the user maintains control over their Bitcoin at all times. And what they're doing is passing messages, and on the blockchain, they don't actually, the Bitcoin never leaves their wallet. It just changes address, changes the face, if you will. There's a lot of different analogies. I think people really, and I know I really struggle to kind of explain how it works in a different context. But the key parts are that a user never gives up control, and it never, the Bitcoin never leaves their wallet. So for money laundering, those are big things. So the comment was made before they had CoinJoin in their wallet. It was referring to custodial mixers, which are in fact money laundering tools. And then further than that, if they would have included, they put one little conversation out of, again, a years long thread, years and years of thread between, you know, high school friends. I think everyone can probably think back to, you know, some group message they have or whatever with high school friends. He goes on to explain why law-abiding citizens on, as we've discussed before, an open and public blockchain ledger might want to use one of these services to protect themselves from criminals. Unfortunately, and it seems to be growing in commonality year after year, there are real dangers if people find out that you are potentially, you know, a holder of a large amount of Bitcoin. We have seen people attacked, kidnapped, and in some cases even killed because of that knowledge. So there are really, you know, viable and legal and sensible reasons why you'd want privacy on Bitcoin.
Yeah, I mean, it just very clearly seems to be a targeted prosecution by centralized authorities, which you know, in large part, what Bitcoin is solving for in the world is the problem of centralized control. I mean, it reminds me of the first time I read the Bitcoin white paper, and I realize what this is solving for. Again, you know, the overreach or dangers of centralized power or centralized control. And for me, it was a very impactful moment because it clicked in my head. Wow, this is solving for one of the biggest problems we've had in humanity, right? And what I'd like to ask you, Lauren, if you can share, you know, as much as you're comfortable with, on Kiani himself and what motivated him, you know, what did he share with you, you know, in the years prior regarding the importance of Bitcoin and what he was building? I think it's clear that he was driven by privacy, by building solutions that other people could use to transact in a sovereign way. But can you give us a little insight into who Kiani was as, you know, as a builder and what he shared with you regarding Bitcoin itself?
Sure. Yeah. So we were attracted, I would say, before Bitcoin. He had heard about Bitcoin, but was a, you know, very early, but was a gold and silver guy. And then it you know, heard about it again a couple of times, and then it reached the point where it clicked, right? And it clicked that, well, yeah, this is gold, this is silver, but you can transact it peer to peer without any intermediaries across the internet. Like so once that clicked, he was completely, you know, bought in love, if you will, with Bitcoin. He definitely comes from a libertarian background. He, you know, believes in freedom and liberty and champions those causes. And so that was another thing that I think drew him to Bitcoin was Bitcoin has a lot of those. And not that, you know, Bitcoin isn't inherently, you know, I guess maybe political, but at least in the early days, it definitely had a more libertarian, magical internet money leaning towards it. So that was all very attractive, and he wanted to work on it because he was so passionate. His kind of background is he's a child of immigrants. His dad's was a Cuban refugee after, you know, at the fall of Cuba, and is, you know, so I think that probably played a factor into it too, of the, you know, a lot of people, they had their lives, their property confiscated and, you know, it ruined, and many died. Thankfully, they were able to escape and come here. And again, another just the promises and freedom of America was really, and I think that's what Bitcoin promised as well, right? and so that's really what drew him to it. And he and Bill, when they met, had a lot of that same ideological leanings behind, like, what is this supposed to be? This is supposed to be peer-to-peer, unconfiscatable, you know, settlement money. And that's really how they viewed it. And when they built Samurai, the industry was kind of starting to lean towards, well, how can we build for so grandma can use it? Let's get, even though it's still quite early, but they were really, it was really focused on mass adoption and more users. And they saw a need that, well, you can't have mass adoption if there's the risk of the traceability. And so they were trying to add back in the fungibility of Bitcoin, which Satoshi did address in, you know, the white paper, that you shouldn't be associating your, you know, real world IDs or linking addresses. And that's kind of, it was shifting at that point. So they were trying to solve what they saw as an issue that needed to be addressed.
Yeah. And just kind of building on that too. So, I mean, I'm just thinking about, you know, coming to the USA as a beacon of freedom, you know, his heritage of his family, and then the way he ended up going through the judicial system in the U.S. How is he today? How does he feel about, you know, being a champion for freedom and then having that freedom taken away from him in the U.S. court system? How's his attitude and his spirit, and how does he feel about what he's built? Because obviously he did it from a purpose of passion and wanting to have tools that help people create, you know, preserve their privacy. So when you talk to him, what is his mindset today?
You know, that's a hard one. I think, you know, as I said, he's still proud of what they built, and it's the code's still out there. And that's a testament to, you know, people still running it. That's a testament to what they built. It's hard. It's hard when the, you know, and this isn't something maybe we've discussed kind of directly on these lines, but you know, even from my own experience, it's really hard when your government comes after you when you think you've been abiding the laws. And it's a weight when the federal government has you in their sights, and you feel very helpless. That's how I feel, at least, that, you know, you just want someone to listen and understand you, especially when they're these conspiracy charges, because they're not saying that they did anything themselves. They're saying they conspired to help other people do something. And that's really hard, because it's all about your intent and your motives. And you're trying to convey to like other people that, no, my heart was in a good place. Like, we're, you know, it wasn't, no one supports these scams and these crimes and stuff that do unfortunately occur in our industry, and that's not what we're being accused of. That's not what they were being accused of. So it's hard. I don't know if he, you know, if he does get out and gets a pardon, if he would be in a place to start building on Bitcoin again, because, you know, 10 years of your life of something that you built to be kind of stripped away it's hard. It's, yeah.
I'd like to shift the conversation a little bit about how this applies broader to innovation and what people, both innovators, founders, developers, and the investors that support them should take from this particular case, and the caution that we should have in what this tells us. You know, there's a couple threads we could go on. One is, what jurisdiction, like, is the U.S. a less friendly jurisdiction than other areas? Another one is, you know, how can you be assured when you feel that you're following the rules that you, you know, that it can't just change midstream? Another is how you communicate, and the messages that you said were, that you shared with us, were definitely taken out of context and didn't even actually refer to the technology that was part of Samurai Wallet. How can a founder be aware of how, what style they communicate? Israel, do you have any specific questions about, you know, bringing this to innovation, the lessons that we learn from this?
Well, I mean, I think these are definitely very important topics, because by nature, anyone who is an entrepreneur and considers themselves an innovator is kind of testing the waters and testing the boundaries of a new technology, of an unsolved problem, of an unmet need. And just by nature, of course, you're going to be experimenting, right? That's what innovators and entrepreneurs have done in the entire history of the human race. So I think the topics you're touching on, Lynn, are extremely important. And well, maybe let's just take them in order. I mean, you started, Lynn, with the dangerous precedent that this sets. And to your earlier points, Lauren, I mean, it sounds like they're really going off of, well, you built a tool that could be used by bad people. You know, perhaps I'm simplifying the words or statement there, but if you really take that at face value, I mean, that applies to quite literally all tools in my mind, right? Physical or digital. So the fact that this is being used in such a targeted prosecution, this argument is dangerous to your point, Lynn. I mean, you know, how can an entrepreneur then safely build in a place like the U.S., which is at least in recent history, been considered one of the safer jurisdictions, one of the most pro-business, pro-entrepreneurship jurisdictions. So, I mean, that begs the question, is the U.S., you know, is the U.S. the friendly place for builders or not? And Lauren, I mean,
if I can just jump in for a second, and this just brings to mind AI and what Anthropic is going through. I mean, there's so much investment funds that have gone into AI. And so for an investor in Silicon Valley that thinks this case doesn't apply to them, it's like they really need to pay attention, because the money that's going into AI could be used for bad purposes. And what Anthropic has gone through with the U.S. government today at this time is an example of that. And Anthropic is one example, but it could be any of the AI tools that are being developed so rapidly right now. Sorry, Israel, it just came to mind, and I just wanted to bring that to, you know, it may not just be Bitcoin tools or freedom tech. It could be any tech.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's spot on. And I mean, Lauren, you have perhaps heard from, you know, developers or other actors in the community. I mean, is this, from what you're hearing, is this already having a chilling effect? How would you describe, I guess, the ripple effects of the Samurai case?
So it definitely has a chilling effect. So, you know, there's ones we know about, and you say about developing within the U.S., but Bill, Curie's business partner, he was in Portugal, and they did a simultaneous, you know, while they were raiding our house in the States, they were raiding him simultaneously in Portugal. So the U.S., the reach of the U.S. is long. The arm of the U.S. is long. But it definitely had, there was many companies that pulled out of and put geo-blocking on the U.S. But as we've seen in other cases, if you don't do that well enough, they'll say you purposely didn't do that well enough and come after you anyway. So it is a real risk. The implication. So yeah, so businesses did pull out. I would say the even further than that, we don't know who was affected and maybe decided not to even attempt to develop a new innovation because of fear that this would come. So it could have implications far further than we know. What's interesting is, as you mentioned, you know, like this could be applied to any tool. There was a Supreme Court ruling in March of this year, and to me, it's very applicable to our case and kind of how it should be being viewed. But again, the line prosecutor is going to have different ideas. But this was a ruling where an ISP was at the Supreme Court level in the U.S. was unanimously decided not found liable for the copyright infringement of their users, even if they knew what was occurring. That should be a one-to-one comparison. If you were not developing or, you know, even that, I don't know, it's a hard analogy, right? Because we don't hold gun manufacturers liable when a criminal uses their tool, because we recognize that it can be used for things that are not criminal. And that's really what the foundation should be. I think we've seen a lot of good talk coming out of the Trump administration, but it could change with future ones. I'm hoping, and I don't know if it's going to take. I think it's going to take people really educating the lawmakers, the congressmen and women, because that it's there. The laws are always trying to play catch up to where the technology is leading. And so they're trying, and in our case, they were applying, you know, laws, the Bank Secrecy Act was written in the 70s to Bitcoin technology, which, you know, at the time these laws were written, you had to physically take custody. You couldn't transact peer-to-peer, you know, across an ocean. That's just not how the system works. So they're trying to shove this new technology into these holes of old law. So there's going to be, as you said, with AI, you know, just these different implications that I think first it really does need to come down to educating them and explaining why this isn't the new scary thing. When cell phones first came out, there was some, and I don't know the specifics, but there was a lot of kind of crazy laws around those where they were trying to, and I think even maybe put a couple people on trial for offering, you know, cell phones that didn't fit into the telecom, the physical old phone, you know, kind of box, if you will.
I really do hope that lawmakers and the people in Washington and politics broadly do open their eyes quickly. I mean, we're living in a moment. I mean, if lawmakers were playing catch up when technology was moving at 10 miles an hour, you know, what hopes can we have for when technology is moving at 100 miles an hour? And we're all living through this kind of exponential change in technology, and it's only accelerating. I want to take it back to where things stand today, Lauren, regarding Kiani, where his possibilities for getting out of his sentence stand. Is it pardon only? I know you are very, of course, active currently, and there's a website, there's a petition to sign, there's all sorts of efforts to draw awareness. And how can people help with where things stand right now, June 2026?
Yeah, thank you so much. As you said, you know, a pardon really is because they took a plea, and because really the appeal process of had we gone to trial and then tried to appeal can take years and years sometimes. And a lot of that time you are serving that time in prison anyway. So that's not an option to us now. And that was one of the factors as to why they did take the plea. But we are seeking a presidential pardon. And I think, you know, again, this administration has been very pro-business and pro-innovation. And I think if the president, you know, when he hears about and knows about the details of this case, this is the same office that came after him himself, right? So he knows their kind of tricks and their tactics of twisting and manipulating evidence to suit their narrative. So that is really kind of what we're after. And part of that, as you mentioned, is signing the petition for calling for a presidential pardon to let the administration know that this is something that individual, you know, people do care about, that innovators care about, that they feel the effects of it. Because as you said, it stifles innovation, and it stifles particularly development in America. So yeah, if people are willing to please sign the petition, they can go to the website. I think you're going to include that in the video for us, for them to click through. Also, if you have the connections, or if you have people to talk to about this case, if it's something you do care about, like that's, as we said before, educating people, because we need to educate the lawmakers on all these different technologies, these emerging technologies, and why they shouldn't. Their reaction shouldn't be to fear them, but to embrace them and try to let them flourish. You know, the biggest economic growth is always when there's the most freedom. And when you're stifling and clamping down on these technologies, whether it be Bitcoin, cryptocurrencies, AI, or, you know, some new thing that we don't even know about yet, it's only going to slow the growth, slow the progress, but it will come about eventually. It's just where you are in it. So talking to people that you know about and then that you know, care about it as well, sharing the story is of such vital importance. And then if people are willing to, we do have donations on there to help with, you know, we are from fighting this court case massively in debt and then continuing to try to spread the word and raise awareness around it is also greatly appreciated.
And that website is billandkiani.org, and we will post that in the show notes together with other resources for helping. But I just want to underscore that, you know, all of innovation is really at risk with this case, this precedent. And we have how many signatures on the petition? 16,000, which to me sounds like a tiny number compared to where we should be. So I would ask everybody listening to this to take a minute and click on the show notes and sign that petition, because that's really what shows the administration that we care about innovation being taken in this direction, that building a tool that could or could not be used for good or for bad is at risk. And we don't want that to happen. So the petition, I think, is important, and certainly supporting you and the legal expenses. Now, Bitcoin Policy Institute has also been a big supporter of you. So you do have a voice on Capitol Hill, and maybe if somebody has some contacts in the administration, where would they be best directed to go, Lauren, to you directly or to Bitcoin Policy Institute, or how do you handle that flow of information?
I would be thrilled to have anyone, you know, reach out to me directly. There's an email at the bottom of the website to reach to me, or, you know, I'm on X as well, and you can find me there. So yes, I'm thrilled to speak to anyone really who has anything they want to lend, because sometimes you never know who does, right? We're talking about innovators, and they'll be able to think about kind of this case and try to raise awareness in a way that I would never consider. So I really do welcome any help, any insights that anyone may have.
We'll certainly include all of this information in the show notes. And Lauren, thank you so much for your time, for sharing all of these details about the case with us. I hope as a community, we can make our voices heard. And just really want to thank you for the time.
Lauren, just as in closing, you know, I met you, you know, we heard about the case before. I met you in April, and then I saw you again in Vegas at the Bitcoin conference. And I just have to compliment on how level-headed and calm and eloquent you are in sharing this story and with all the emotion that must come with it. And just want to thank you for being such an important voice for bringing this awareness. Where do you get your strength, and what gives you hope today in the face of everything that's happened?
Well, thank you both so much. This is so kind. I guess my faith, really, that's kind of has definitely been a comfort and a peace in this. And if I didn't have that, I think I would maybe be kind of, I don't know. Not know what to do, but it's that. And then it's also just the fact that I have this, and you know, to thank people like you for giving me this opportunity to spread the message. Cause if I didn't have kind of something to direct this energy and try to make this change and try to get this pardon done, it would be hard. I think it would be really hard to just kind of sit at home and, you know, notice, and I do that anyways, but then I can direct it somewhere. So like, right, I noticed that, you know, if I make coffee in the morning, it's just coffee for one, where before I would have made his coffee as well. Or, you know, the side of the bed's not, you know, not messed up. I don't have to make it because he didn't sleep there last night. He slept in a prison cell. So like, just having platforms like yours that you're willing to share with me and allow me to speak on just is so meaningful to me. So thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lauren. We really appreciate your time and your story, and we'll do what we can to help get Keone out of prison. Thank you for listening to this episode of Build with Bitcoin. If you found it of value, please take a second to like, subscribe, or share. This helps the visibility and reach of our podcast so that more people are aware of the innovation happening in and around Bitcoin. It truly means a lot. I'd also like to take this opportunity to invite you to join us at an event that Israel and I are hosting, Meet to Tech Talks 2026, taking place from October 25th to the 27th at the exclusive Punta Mita Resort in Mexico. This will be an intimate gathering of 125 invite-only participants exploring how the future of capital is being shaped by the intersection of Bitcoin, artificial intelligence, and energy. To request an invite or for more information, visit mitatechtalks.com. We hope you'll join us. And thanks again for being a part of the Build with Bitcoin community.